and distribution of medication. It's what's responsible for the high prices and the lack of availability to people who need it most. I do also want to say something I think is really important in terms of domestic issues, and that is that we are framing this conversation erroneously. We're talking about the need to recruit more and more people of color. The figures given by Dr. Fauci, 27%. African-Americans represent 13.3% of people in the country. So Fauci is suggesting that twice our representation should be in these vaccine trials. Why? Unfortunately, this is a subtle form of blaming the victim by hanging the success of vaccine design on African-Americans and Hispanic people. That we're imparting responsibility that is not fair, because in reality, their fear, their reticence to engage in vaccine design is not the problem. The problem is the untrustworthiness of the U.S. healthcare system. We have to address both things. We can't just talk about African-American and Hispanic behavior and not talk about a healthcare system that is creating a situation where logical people have a rational fear.
We have to leave it there. I want to thank you, Harriet Washington, for joining us, author of Medical Apartheid, and Kaushik Sundararajan, professor of anthropology at University of Chicago. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Stay safe.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio wants to know what you care about this election season. We want to ask our listeners one simple question. What do you think candidates should be talking about as they compete for votes? Let us know by filling out our Citizens Agenda survey, and you can be entered into a sweepstakes to win a $50 Visa prepaid gift card. The responses we get from our community will inform our reporting on the November election. We want our coverage to serve our community, and we need your help to make it happen. If you would like to participate and be entered to win $50, open your web browser and type bit.ly/KBOO survey into the address line. Again, that's bit.ly/KBOO survey. And thanks.
We don't get pool again.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available at our website. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, powerful wildfires tear through Oregon, sending thousands fleeing from their homes. The governor says they're a sign of things to come. Portland's mayor moves to ban the use of tear gas on protesters, and Portland may make history with its new ban on facial recognition technology. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, September 10th, 2020. KBOO is currently in our membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Althea Billings. As Oregon wildfires continue to rage across the state, some relief may be on the horizon. State officials announced on Wednesday that an opening to more directly containing the fires is nearing, thanks to an upcoming change in the weather. The Santiam or Beachy Creek fire remains the largest blaze, having consumed over 182,000 acres as of Thursday morning, with most of the fire's growth towards Scotts Mills and Drake's Crossing areas. Two additional megafires are located in nearby areas. The Riverside Fire is burning near Estacada and Malala at 120,000 acres, while the Lion's Head Fire has burned 106,000 acres near Mount Jefferson and Detroit. Fire officials are reporting a decrease in strong east winds today that is helping to slow the spread of the multiple wildfires. Rain is in the forecast beginning early next week for much of the area westward to the coastal region. With resources spread thin, Portland Fire and Rescue said as of Wednesday evening it had responded to more than 500 fire incidents within the city since Monday. Four wildfires are still burning in Clackamas County, where most of the area's residents are currently under Level 1 and 2 evacuation orders. The town of Malala, east of Highway 213, is under a Level 3 evacuation order, which means residents should leave immediately. Several evacuation sites have been set up. The Clackamas County Fairgrounds in Canby is full, but people can set up RVs in the east parking lot of Clackamas Town Center. Tent and RV sites are available at the Elks Lodge in Oak Grove, south of Milwaukee. Residents can check the county website, clackamas.us/wildfires, for updates. OPB reporter Sergio Olmos was in Malala reporting on the wildfires today when he was forced out of the area at gunpoint by two armed men who claimed they were militia members, who had set up an unsanctioned checkpoint and were checking vehicles. Meanwhile, in southern Oregon, National Weather Service officials in Medford have also reported lessening winds and upcoming rain, but numerous fires continue to burn, and many homes in the evacuated towns of Talent and Phoenix have been destroyed. The majority of current fires were ignited on Monday due to extremely dry and windy conditions across much of the state, with at least 7 lives lost and an unknown number of homes and businesses burned in this unprecedented fire emergency. The smoke you see and smell in the air and the fires around us are a bellwether of the future, according to Oregon's governor, and evacuation orders in Clackamas County have been expanded. KBOO's Annette Newell has these stories and more on why this extreme event has happened in Oregon.
Evacuations are ongoing and growing. 900,000 acres have burned in Oregon. If you're advised to evacuate, do so, because you might not get another chance. Those are some of the key messages from Oregon Governor Kate Brown's news conference this afternoon. She praised the efforts of Oregon's National Guard, the Army Corps of Engineers, Red Cross volunteers, and many others, she says. They're saving lives, and their efforts are nothing short of heroic. We hope this is the final day of the wind event, she said, but the weather is not giving firefighters a reprieve. She warns that we're facing unstable air conditions and unpredictable movement of fires across the landscape. Pointedly, she said, this combination of drier, hotter, windier weather is a bellwether of the future. She said it's the direct impact of climate change. She says she hopes emergency workers will soon be able to switch from their efforts to save lives to focus on stopping and containing the fires. Oregon's put out national emergency requests for help. She said Utah has responded and is sending help. The governor asked for active duty military help from the federal government. She says she's asking universities and community colleges to work with their students who are trained as firefighters to work without being penalized by those schools. And the governor announced she's forming a disaster cabinet to deal with the wildfires' impact, from social services to health to agriculture. She says it's an extremely difficult time for many Oregonians. Thousands of people have packed whatever they could into their cars before leaving their homes and are now staying in shelters. We're doing everything in our power to support you, she said. We will help you get through this. Fire experts pointed out the Riverside Fire down Highway 211 has jumped through Estacada. They expressed fears that the Beachy Fire and the Riverside Fire could combine, becoming even more dangerous. They're asking Oregonians to abide by evacuation orders, and they say they need some better conditions with the winds before they can really fight the fires. Right now, their focus is on saving lives and buildings. At Sandy Amp Canyon, they're making progress on containment lines and moving from a posture of life-saving to suppression. Overall, firefighters say they made the first step toward containment in 72 hours of work, and they're only at 5% containment. In southwest Oregon, another point of concern, they're experiencing another fire, a California fire, which moved into Oregon, which happens to be the number one fire in the nation. An evacuation zone in Clackamas County has expanded to include the city of Malala. They're pleading with people who have evacuated throughout the state to not go back to their homes yet. It is not safe. And to register on the Red Cross Safe and Well list so their loved ones can know they're okay. Scientists have for years predicted that as greenhouse gases keep adding up, trapping heat and warming the earth, droughts would get more common and more intense in the West. Much of Oregon has warmed by about 2 degrees in the past century, and the U.S. Drought Monitor reports that more than 90% of Oregon is abnormally dry. That, combined with forests brimming with dry fuels and a low-pressure system that brought intense winds, it added up to an historic wildfire outbreak in Oregon. For the KBOO Evening News, I'm Annette Newell.
Early this morning, a home on Stark Street across from Buckman Elementary School caught fire. The event caused even more stress for residents affected by the fire, given the already overwhelming fear of displacement because of the forest fires ravaging Oregon. KBOO's Claire Rosciato spoke with a resident who lives in the duplex next to the home that burned, as well as a fire inspector who was on the scene.
Early this morning, around 7 a.m., a southeast Stark Street home across from Buckman Elementary School lit a flame, and the fire caused damage to a next-door two-story duplex. The home is still standing, though very badly destroyed, and residents were able to re-enter their homes in the duplex. No known injuries or deaths occurred. I myself, a resident in the Buckman neighborhood, started my morning hearing several fire truck sirens. As I quickly stepped outside in front of Revolution Hall, I saw rows upon rows of first responders and fire trucks lining at least 3 blocks of Stark Street. When I arrived on the scene, the fire had been put out and firewomen and men were assessing the damage. As it turned out, I knew a former tenant who had lived in the home that had caught fire. Her father, who owned the home, was helping his mother the previous night evacuate Mount Hood because of the rampant and destructive forest fires. He'd learned overnight that a person was sleeping on his porch, and he'd planned on removing the person this morning. However, he was unable to because of the fire. During the aftermath, I spoke with a tenant, Ariel, who lives upstairs in the two-story duplex. She shared with me how she started her morning waking up to a fire. Here's more with my conversation with Ariel.
So you're a resident in this house?
I live next door. I live upstairs.
You live upstairs? Okay. So the two-story house?
Uh-huh, it's a duplex.
Duplex. So what happened?
I woke up to yelling, and I thought that's weird, and I went to my front window and looked out, and the blazes were already huge on the front porch here. I ran back, got my phone, got a robe, and I thought my dog was right behind me. I ran out. I had a bag packed for the forest fires, wait potentially to evacuate.
So you were ready.
I grabbed the bag. I don't have my car keys, so I can't go anywhere.
Yeah.
But and unfortunately, my dog ran back inside, and then I knew not to re-enter because the blazes were going up to the side of the house.
Is your dog okay?
She is okay.
Okay.
The firefighter got her. She's with another neighbor now.
Okay.
While talking to 911, they said they were sending people immediately. They had gotten multiple calls, and it was just a fireball. Like, the whole front of the house was, and the fire crew got here in probably 2 minutes.
Wow. Okay, good.
And that's what's been, I mean, I don't know what else to tell you. That's...
Are your things okay? Are you okay? How are you doing?
I am clearly...
You're shocked.
I was expecting maybe wildfires and evacuation, not like a house fire on my house. I'm glad that the other thing is this house has been both abandoned and squatted in for a while. And there was, last night when I was walking up to my porch, I saw somebody, I don't know if the politically correct term, and I don't know if I want to use, like, squatter, I don't, was on the porch.
Okay.
Which happens quite frequently because there aren't residents.
Right.
I try to mind my own business. People need places to rest and sleep.
Sure.
I'm assuming that's how the fire started.
Later on, I also spoke with Jason Birch, Portland's senior fire inspector, who was able to provide some details about the incident, but not great detail about the fire because it is under investigation. He does warn and stress to residents of the Portland area that even fires as small compared to the forest fires, such as a house fire, require excessive amounts of resources. And he asks residents to be very mindful of this and to be careful. Here's more with my conversation with Portland Senior Fire Inspector Jason Birch.
My name is Jason Birch. I'm a Senior Fire Inspector, Assistant PIO. Today we had a fire involving a single-family residence. The fire started on the exterior and it spread to the neighboring house. Conditions are ripe for fire to spread right now due to the dryness, weather conditions and such. We're asking everybody to be attentive and fire safe. The fire itself was significant. It did displace some residents. There were no injuries. The area is right now just inundated with fire equipment and vehicles. We ask you avoid the area. An important thing to remember is that these fires are spreading rapidly. They're taking a lot of resources. We're asking the public just to keep that in mind. Be safe. Please be fire safe. And remember, the fire ban is in place right now.
Can you say how many people had to evacuate their homes?
In this situation, yes. I don't know how many residents were affected. The fire did spread to a second home. It was only on the exterior. It doesn't look like they'll be displaced. But the fire in the original house, where it started on the exterior, has been extensive. Those people will be displaced.
And do you know how it started?
It is undetermined at this time. The cause is under investigation.
Okay, thank you.
Well, absolutely.
This is Claire Rosciotto with KBOO Evening News.
Portland City Council passed the toughest facial recognition ban in the U.S. on Wednesday, blocking both public and private use of the technology. The ban passed unanimously, with the new law established as two ordinances. One ordinance prohibits public use of facial recognition. It goes into effect immediately, with city bureaus ordered to complete an assessment of their facial recognition usage within 90 days. An ordinance to prohibit private use of the technology takes effect on January 1st of 2021, making Portland the first U.S. city to do so. Amazon spent $24,000 lobbying against Portland's legislation, but has declined to comment on its opposition to the facial recognition restrictions. Facial recognition software has been found to have race, age, and ethnic biases, raising concerns about civil liberties and misidentification of people, particularly by law enforcement. Research has uncovered frequent racial and gender bias issues with facial recognition algorithms, with the Detroit Police Department admitting the technology misidentifies people 96% of the time, often leading to wrongful arrests. Portland City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty addressed those concerns during Wednesday's meeting. She said, quote, "This is really about making sure we are prioritizing our most vulnerable community members and community members of color." Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler said, quote, "Portlanders should never be in fear of having their right to privacy be exploited by either their government or by a private institution." The new law will ban police officers from using facial recognition to identify potential suspects, as well as prohibiting stores and businesses, including airlines, from using the technology. Other American cities to pass legislation on banning government agencies from using facial recognition include Boston, San Francisco, and Oakland. Mayor Ted Wheeler banned the use of CS gas, a common tear gas used to disperse protesters today. Here's KBOO's Nat Moon with the story.
After more than 100 days of protests against police brutality in the city of Portland, Mayor Ted Wheeler banned the use of CS gas for crowd control today. The ban applies to the Portland Police Bureau and only applies specifically to CS gas, one of the many gases used to disperse demonstrators. Other chemical and impact munitions are still available for use by law enforcement. The ban is effective immediately and until further notice. In a statement earlier today, Wheeler said he is calling on, quote, "everyone to step up and tamp down the violence." Wheeler has received much criticism for his inaction in the last 3+ months, during which thousands of people have been subjected to dangerous chemical weapons, munitions, and physical assault by law enforcement officers. The order comes at a time when the city of Portland faces serious fires, and after multiple homes near Portland's East Precinct filled with gas after a night of heavy munitions use by PPB. The order also comes days after a poll was released in which Wheeler's approval rating was 26%. The ban only applies to officers in the Portland Police Bureau, meaning no ban on the use of CS gas by state or federal law enforcement. Dr. Juniper Simonis, who has been studying the use and effects of these chemical agents, said today that certain chemicals used in pepper balls and other munitions are, quote, as bad or maybe even worse tear gases than CS. Simonis and others are saying the ban is not enough. Since the use of chemical weapons is prohibited internationally by the Geneva Protocol, the use of chemical weapons on U.S. citizens by U.S. law enforcement has raised many questions about the morality and legality of such actions, including lawsuits filed in cities all over the country. Reporting for KABU, I'm Nat Moon.
You are listening to a fall membership drive special of the KABU Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KABU membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned at 5:30 for Making Contact, where this week hosts explore the corporate grab of public water. Then it's Rose City Native Radio at 6, and at 7 it's Popular Education. Tonight's weather will see widespread areas of smoke and haze, reducing visibility down to a low of 57 overnight, and tomorrow it will be mostly sunny with a high of 87. An air quality advisory is in effect until noon on Monday. Today in history, on this date in 1897, a London taxi driver named George Smith became the first person ever arrested for drunk driving after slamming his cab into a building. He pleaded guilty and was fined 25 shillings. The quote of the day is from Candy Leitner, the founder of Mothers Against Drunk Driving. She said, quote, "The road through grief is a rocky one. Traveling along it requires courage, patience, wisdom, and hope." A virtual healthcare plan has become a reality in Washington state. Eric Tegedoff has more on that story.
The COVID-19 pandemic is speeding up the trend for healthcare online. Kaiser Permanente is offering Washingtonians virtual plus coverage plans geared toward assessing and treating patients over the internet. Todd Hesse with Kaiser says the pandemic has shifted the way people think about care, with virtual visits increasing from 20% of all visits to 65%. He says in part that's because many people are concerned about the safety of going into an office setting.
What Virtual Plus does is it provides options to an individual for seeking virtual care versus having to go into an office if they aren't comfortable in doing that.
Hesse notes people with Virtual Plus plans can connect via chat and email 24/7 as well. He says a person's electronic medical records are linked to them, no matter how they choose to connect. Hesse says another consideration is that the plan is cheaper, an important attribute for some patients with so much uncertainty in the economy.
It's a lower cost plan that really gives an individual more options and, quite frankly, more control over their own healthcare costs based on how they choose to access care.
Hesse says doctors like virtual visits too, because it makes care more convenient for people without reliable transportation.
Our clinicians have long embraced being able to assess, treat individuals virtually, because that removes just one of the barriers that we had historically seen to care.
A trip to the pharmacy isn't required under Virtual Plus plans either. Folks can have their medications delivered to their homes. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden visits auto workers in Michigan, while President Donald Trump defends himself for downplaying the coronavirus pandemic, which Bob Woodward's new book says he admitted to. With more on these stories, we go to Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
I don't buy for one second that the vitality of American manufacturing is a thing of the past. We have the most qualified workers in the world.
Former Vice President Joe Biden was in Michigan for the first time since the pandemic, visiting auto workers yesterday in Macomb County, many who supported President Donald J. Trump in 2016. Job growth nationally slowed under Trump before the coronavirus outbreak, according to factcheck.org, and over 55,000 manufacturing jobs have been lost in Michigan alone. Trump's visiting the key battleground state tonight. Lonnie Scott with Progress Michigan says unions are a core constituency in the state.
Those strong union roots are what really build and run through the families here in Michigan.
Biden called Trump, quote, negligent over allegations from The Washington Post's Bob Woodward's new book that the president knew how deadly the virus was in February, but didn't sound the alarm.
He knew and purposely played it down. Worse, he lied to the American people. He knowingly and willingly lied about the threat it posed to the country for months.
Woodward is one of the journalists who uncovered the Watergate scandal that ended the Nixon presidency. Trump didn't deny the account, saying yesterday,
"The last thing we can show is panic."
Donald Sherman with the Center for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington thinks the president's motivation might have been more personal and more financial.
One has to question why the president routinely downplayed the coronavirus pandemic and whether the fact that he owns a business in the hospitality industry is a reason for not being as forthcoming and moving as quickly to address the pandemic.
Lawsuits continue in multiple states to ease voting during the pandemic. Texas officials still resist changes like a polling place mask mandate and curbside voting, which Alabama courts are also considering. Louisiana is one of just a handful of states, like Texas, where fear of contracting COVID is not a valid excuse to vote absentee. You need a doctor's note saying you're sick or at extremely high risk to get a mail-in ballot. Ashley Shelton's group, the Power Coalition for Equity and Justice in Louisiana, is one of the plaintiffs suing this state to change it.
Why would we distract our medical professionals from the work in hand, which is saving lives in the midst of a pandemic, for folks to have to get a doctor's note? Not everybody has access to a doctor or can afford the copay or whatever those barriers are. And so it basically results in a poll tax.
Yesterday, new polls showed Biden up 9 points in Pennsylvania and 5 points in Wisconsin, both battleground states. Trump, reviving one method he used in 2016 to win over conservatives, revealed the 20 people on his wish list for Supreme Court nominees, including 3 conservative Republican senators, Tom Cotton of Arkansas, Ted Cruz of Texas, and Josh Hawley of Missouri. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
South Asian Americans in the West are speaking out against caste oppression. Suzanne Potter has the story.
As a summer of protests over racial discrimination comes to a close, South Asian groups are fighting for recognition of a similar phenomenon, discrimination based on caste. Caste apartheid is a centuries-old system of oppression common in India and surrounding regions that divides people into 5 categories, ranging from the favored Brahmin caste down to the Dalits, formerly known as untouchables. Thanmori Sandararajan with the Dalit civil rights group Equality Labs recently published an op-ed in Yes magazine on the hatred that affects 5 million South Asian Americans.
We have been seeing many people in caste-oppressed communities struggling with violence and discrimination and slurs. And, you know, we left behind our homelands to escape caste apartheid. And so to see it rear its ugly head here is intolerable and also against the law.
In June, the California Department of Fair Employment and Housing launched a civil rights case alleging that the tech company Cisco failed to protect a Dalit employee who suffered slurs and lost promotions when his caste status became known. A study on caste discrimination commissioned by Equality Labs found that here in the U.S., 1 in 4 Dalits has suffered physical violence, 1 in 3 has encountered discrimination in school, and 2 out of 3 have felt it at the office. Sandra Rajan says it's time for caste to be recognized as a protected civil rights category within companies and at the local, state, and federal level.
So this is a very significant moment in this new terrain of civil rights, because we are seeing caste-oppressed Americans all across the United States asking for protections.
Advocates are also calling on Senator and Vice Presidential candidate Kamala Harris, who is from the Brahmin caste, to denounce caste-based discrimination. This story was produced with original reporting from Thanmori Sandararajan for Yes Media. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
A tax deferral means fatter paychecks in 2020, but leaner ones in 2021. Ross Brown has more.
many American workers will enjoy a 6.2% bump in their take-home pay for the rest of the year, but leaner paychecks are coming in 2021. A tax deferment began September 1st via executive order by President Donald Trump. It means workers don't have to pay their part of the tax that goes to fund Social Security. Trump has promised, if reelected, to make the tax cuts permanent, but hasn't explained how he would fund Social Security. Andy Landis worked at the agency for 12 years and believes caution is in order to preserve what has proven to be one of the nation's soundest financial systems.
I like to say that it's the one anti-poverty program that actually ends poverty. There's so many people that would be in poverty if Social Security was not there or if their Social Security was cut.
Under the executive order, the IRS will suspend collecting Social Security payroll tax from workers who earn less than $104,000 a year. Landis believes Social Security is strong, but says it's also at a turning point because baby boomers are retiring and collecting their funds. A similar suspension of taxes was enacted in 2010 to boost a stagnant economy due to the Great Recession, but the legislation required the money be funneled back to the Social Security Trust Fund. Landis wants to see a similar promise going forward.
There's no guarantee that it's going to be made whole by some other source like general fund. So that really worries me that you would simply cut Social Security's income when it's hungry for income because of demographics.
Landis adds the effectiveness of Social Security as a safety net cannot be overstated.
Look at the two words. It's social because we all participate in it, and it brings security because it's there even during downturns, during the Depression, during the 08 downturn. It's always there.
Private employers do not have to participate in the tax deferment, but it's a requirement for federal employees, including enlisted military service members. For Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
You are listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Nat Moon, Claire Rosciato, Jeffrey Wade, and Annette Newell. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Eric Tegadoff, Roz Brown, and Suzanne Potter. Our evening news director is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. We are currently in our fall membership drive, so if you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give, or even use our mobile app and click on donate. Stay tuned now for Making Contact.
This week on Making Contact. Water is critical to maintaining the balance of all life on Earth. As humans go, the United Nations estimates that each person needs about 50 to 100 liters a day for drinking and washing. It must be safe, accessible, and affordable. And then there are large corporations that claim ownership of freshwater sources to bottle and sell for profit.
We were sitting on our property and heard well drilling operations, and we wondered what was going on, who was digging a well. A neighbor informed us that the previous property owner had sold to Crystal Geyser. There was never any public notice published, which was really frustrating.
Other companies use water as a tool to extract oil and gas from the ground.
And until legislators can provide 100% assurance that there's no risk to public health, there's no risk to the environment, and there's no risk to freshwater resources in the management of oil and gas waste or produced water, regulators should move very cautiously, if at all.
This is Wolves at the Well, the corporate grab of public water on Making Contact. I'm Monica Lopez. When you reach for that plastic bottle of water, do you know where the water inside came from? While much bottled water is sourced from municipal taps, expensive premium bottled water actually does come from pristine springs located in remote rural areas. Oregon producer Barbara Bernstein explores the impacts that large water bottling facilities have on these rural areas and why residents in targeted communities are fighting back against water bottlers like Nestle and Crystal Geyser.
For the vast majority of human existence and civilization, water has been perceived as a common resource not to be owned and bought and sold. As we head into a climate crisis, we really got to make sure water gets defined as a public resource.
The Pacific Northwest is a water-abundant region with many small towns reeling from the loss of their primary industry, logging. The commercial water bottling industry has been eyeing many of these communities as prime locations to site large water bottling plants. Cascade Locks is a small logging town in the Columbia River Gorge, about 40 miles east of Portland, Oregon, whose lumber mill shut down in 1988.
It was pretty devastating to the local economy and I think to the social fabric of the community when the mill closed down.
Aurora Del Valle lives in Cascade Locks and was the campaign director for the Local Water Alliance.
People here were understandably desperate because this is an economically depressed area and a prime candidate for corporations like Nestle to come in and say, hey, we can save your town.
In 2008, Nestle approached city leaders with an offer to build a water bottling facility that would draw water from a pristine spring just outside town. They were warmly received by the Cascade Locks mayor and city manager and most of the city council. Julia DeGraw was a Northwest organizer for Food and Water Watch, one of several environmental organizations that led the fight to stop Nestle from building their water bottling plant.
Anybody in Cascade Locks who didn't want to see a multinational corporation with Nestle's track record of damaging local water resources coming into their town were very scared, frankly, to speak out against their elected leadership and to disagree with their neighbors.
The mayor and the city council and the city manager, they were trying to silence us. We'd have members keep going to the city council meetings and also the Port of Cascade Locks meetings and say, this is not a done deal.
As the opponents of Nestle's water bottling plant became more frustrated and angry, they also began to get more organized.
We ended up demanding that we wanted a true town hall meeting, not a Nestle-sponsored town hall meeting.
Every other public meeting had been hosted by Nestle and some moderator they hired. So all of a sudden, there was this just boiling point where people showed up and could actually ask their elected officials direct questions about why are we doing this and how is this in our best interest.
One thing that came up in the town hall meeting was, why not put it to a vote to the city? But we were advised that doing a countywide measure would spread the news about the danger of having these water extractors come in.
As word of Nestle's plans got out to the rest of Hood River County, where Cascade Locks is situated, opposition swelled, even though the plant was still favored by many Cascade Locks residents and nearly all its elected officials.
Most of the time when Nestle wants to open up a water bottling facility, the fight never goes beyond the city or county level. The water that Nestle wanted to bottle was spring water that was used by the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, a state agency, for a fish hatchery. What they did not anticipate was that a state agency had to go through our process to make this public water available to a multinational corporation for water bottling purposes. And it gave all the organizations that eventually formed the Keep Nestle Out of the Gorge Coalition an opportunity to make this a statewide issue. We're talking about water, which is a common public resource owned by every Oregonian. And Nestle, which trucks water up to 500 miles away from their water bottling sites. So the impact wasn't going to stick just in Cascade Locks.
In 2015, local activists formed the Local Water Alliance to launch a ballot measure to make commercial water bottling plants and shipping water out of the county for commercial uses illegal in Hood River County. While the measure did not have majority support in the city of Cascade Locks, it found broad support across the rest of the county.
Because Hood River County produces a lot of food for the region, for the nation, we really did a lot of outreach with farmers on both sides of the river. We got over 100 local businesses and over 60 farms and orchards to sign on and support us.
In May 2016, the ballot initiative passed with 69% of the vote. However, in the city of Cascade Locks, the initiative was defeated by a narrow margin. Ballot initiative proponents steeled themselves for the city to appeal the measure, while hoping that Oregon Governor Kate Brown would step in and stop the water rights exchange that would allow Nestle to use the spring water.
It was such a high to pass it, and then it was so disappointing to have just a complete lack of action on the governor's part. It was just frustrating to know that we had to keep the fight going, where we generated a bunch of phone calls and emails to the governor. So she got a lot of contacts from citizens being like, please don't do this. right smack dab in the middle of Governor Brown's reelection campaign, I think she recognized that in a contentious election cycle, she does not want to be the governor who is standing by while Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife is making water available to Nestle for water bottling. So Governor Brown publicly came out and said that it is not in the best interest of our state to allow ODFW to do a water rights exchange and to please withdraw their application.
Finding that out, I felt like I had 500 pounds lift from my shoulders because the city was getting geared up for a battle to appeal.
About a year after Cascade Locks drove Nestle out of the gorge, a similar water battle erupted 100 miles north in the tiny community of Randall, Washington.
We were sitting on our property and heard well drilling operations, and we wondered what was going on, who was digging a well.
Craig Jasmer is a Randall resident and a founding member of the Lewis County Water Alliance.
A neighbor informed us that the previous property owner had sold to Crystal Geyser. There was never any public notice published, which was really frustrating.
They paid close to $700,000 for the property when it was valued at something in the $200,000s.
Alex Brown was a local reporter with the Chronicle, covering Lewis County during the Crystal Geyser incident.
That certainly raised a few eyebrows. Given the opposition that these proposals have faced in so many small communities, it really did seem like they were trying to fly under the radar as much as they possibly could.
Initially, we were shocked as to why Crystal Geyser would have purchased the property out here, because we knew that the county zoning wouldn't allow such an industry out there. And then as we started our investigation, what we found was that the zoning had recently been changed to allow for food and beverage manufacturing of this size in our zone.
They were interested in allowing craft breweries and wineries who wanted to have some sort of on-site tasting. But ultimately, that change in the zoning ended up opening up a loophole for Crystal Geyser to come in. Randall's a quiet rural area. Folks, when they started hearing about this proposal, were going, okay, I retired out here in the countryside, and now we're going to have a plant the size of a Walmart. We're going to have semi-truck traffic going up and down the road where my grandkids ride their bikes. People started to raise concerns about well water and the aquifer being depleted. Very quickly became a fairly organized movement.
Initially, we gathered a small group of our neighbors and decided that we needed to stop it, but we wouldn't be able to stop it just ourselves. So we organized a town hall meeting in Randall and invited the county commissioner, the county manager, who both showed up.
By my count, there were at least 300 people there, including many who couldn't even get into the building, who were just listening on speakers outside.
We had some spokespersons from the Cowlitz Indian tribe. We got the facts that we had discovered from public records requests. When the community heard these facts, they were outraged. They all came together and knew that it was going to take all of them to stop it.
Part of the reason the response in Randall was so organized and effective was that they did communicate with people from Cascade Locks and some of these other communities who have gone to war with some of these bottling companies and fought, successfully or not, against a lot of these proposals.
We started communicating with our local government, with the state government, making waves wherever we could.
People were showing up in force to county commission meetings for months, where you'd have people driving 2 hours across the county to show up and speak.
We'd have 30 people who gave a 3-minute talk on Crystal Geyser and basically took over every meeting. They knew that we were a force to be reckoned with and that they had to do something, otherwise they were going to continue to have a lot of interruptions in their meetings and not get anything done.
Pretty much at all levels of county government, people were telling me they had never seen this level of engagement on an issue, let alone from a small rural community an hour away from the county seat.
Basically, what we were talking about doing was just putting a halt on any permit applications for food and beverage manufacturing until they studied that zoning criteria and decided whether or not they wanted to keep it the way it was. If Crystal Geyser had gone ahead and submitted an application with the county prior to that moratorium being in effect, they would have been grandfathered in and they would have a bottling plant there today.
The people in Randall decided that they needed to act not only on a county level, but also on the state level.
This wasn't the first time that these bottling companies have tried to come into Washington or into Oregon. And it's always these small towns in the rural areas that are targeted. They're the ones who have the least amount of defense against these big corporations. We felt like it was the neighborly thing to do to try to educate the state on what we had learned at the county level and try to protect all of our neighbors throughout the state.
In the middle of this contentious battle, Crystal Geiser's COO sent an email to Chronicle reporter Alex Brown, requesting that he write an article about how other communities have benefited from having a Crystal Geiser bottling facility sited in their community. Brown responded that since they refused to go on the record with him, he would not print their PR. To his surprise, he received back a revealing email from the COO.
My impression is that he intended to forward that email to the company president, but accidentally replied to me, essentially saying, the Chronicle's not going to play ball and reprint our PR. Everyone's against us. This project is probably dead. But here's a last-ditch plan we can try to use to sue the local subdivision preemptively and just use very strong-arm tactics to try to get the project through when they clearly lost in the court of public opinion at that point. They were somewhat flabbergasted that we intended to print that information. So very quickly had a multi-billion dollar law firm threaten to sue us and put a restraining order on us if we attempted to publish it. We knew that that was all a bluff, and so we ran it in the next day's newspaper. The opposition got even louder and more unified, and it pretty much directly led to county commissioners revising and clarifying the code to disallow large-scale water bottling for commercial purposes, which in effect killed the project and marked a successful end to this local movement.
The Chronicle story inspired a bill introduced in the Washington State Senate that would ban groundwater extraction for commercial bottling. Craig Jasmer with the Lewis County Water Alliance.
The idea of the bill was that you're not able to apply for a permit for a water right in the state of Washington if the purpose is to take the water out of the ground and bottle it and ship it out of the state.
The bill did pass the state Senate, but in the House it did not make it out of committee and so was killed, at least for now.
It was disheartening to see the corporate lobbyists come in and explain why they should vote against it. Really no reason other than for corporate profits.
We need to have a much more widespread policy to protect public water because it's battle fatigue for small town people to have to do this over and over again.
Aurora Del Valle, Cascade Locks Local Water Alliance.
And I hope that Washington will be the first state in the nation to make commercial water bottling illegal.
For Making Contact, this is Barbara Bernstein.
You're listening to Wolves at the Well on Making Contact. Making Contact is offered for free to radio stations across the country and around the world. Follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. Coming up, while some companies are going after freshwater sources to sell for a profit, others use some combination of fresh and what's known as produced water to extract oil and gas from the ground. We'll hear from producer Elizabeth Miller when we return. As climate change makes for increasing drought and heat in the southwestern United States, New Mexico is also facing high demand on its water supplies from the oil and gas industry and a glut of wastewater. The state is studying ways to reuse that water, both inside and outside the oil field, leading the way in research and technology development that could shape policy and practices around the nation. But to some, the state is foolishly opening itself to increased risk from toxic waste. Producer Elizabeth Miller has the story.
In January, an oil and gas well pipeline that runs 100 feet from Penny O'Coin and D. George's home in southern New Mexico burst, spraying their house, yard, and livestock with oil well wastewater. In the months since, they've had to euthanize the chickens that were covered with that water, as well as a dog that drank some of it. The oil company responsible for the spill, WPX, tested the yard for toxic compounds and radiation, but O'Coin and George worry it wasn't comprehensive and are frustrated that contaminated soil wasn't removed. The company has not, to their knowledge, been fined for the spill.
We're still waiting for a resolution. There is probably very little resolution. They took and sprayed a little microblaze on the property that probably took away the smell of the gas, and that's about it. Because the trees are dying. They have black stuff going up them. There's no birds in our trees. There's no, I mean, I don't even see bugs out in my grass. There's nothing growing. It's dead. Everything out there is dead. There's no resolution. Absolutely none.
The water that covered their home is known as produced water. Some of it is fresh water used to frack the well, but the majority of it comes from underground reservoirs as old as the oil itself. It is often very salty, and it is always laced with the chemicals used to hydraulically fracture an oil well, as well as heavy metals and even radioactive materials. New Mexico produced 329 million barrels of oil in 2019. Each barrel of oil brought with it 4 to 7 barrels of produced water. The New Mexico Environment Department estimates 90% of that wastewater is pumped back underground for storage, permanently removed from the water cycle. New Mexico sees less than 20 inches of rain per year. It's a water-scarce area. The search for new ways to conserve water prompted New Mexico lawmakers in 2019 to approve a bill to strengthen regulations and encourage oil and gas companies to reuse water rather than dispose of it. But the bill also tasked the Environment Department with drafting rules for reusing oil industry wastewater outside of the oil field. That could potentially include watering crops and perhaps even someday supplying drinking water taps. Proponents said the measure had the potential to turn the desert green.
There is ample space to have an optimistic outlook.
Representative Nathan Small, who hails from southern New Mexico, sponsored the bill. He says it's far too soon to say what the research will produce, but he's hopeful.
You know, not only must the science be there, be sound, be safe, of course, there also must be ways that are economical, that work for communities and all different stakeholders, including private sector stakeholders, including conservation stakeholders, to help implement some of these potential solutions and approaches at a scale that is appropriate.
But environmental advocates like Rebecca Sobel with Wild Earth Guardians worry the state may be putting public health, the environment, and its rare freshwater resources at risk of contamination.
People are rightfully asking questions about the public health impacts of these toxic, hazardous, radioactive materials. And until legislators can provide 100% assurance that there's no risk to public health, there's no risk to the environment, and there's no risk to freshwater resources in the management of oil and gas waste or produced water, regulators should move very cautiously, if at all.
A rule on reusing produced water for other uses outside of the industry is likely several years out, says the state's Water Protection Division Director, Rebecca Roos.
Our rulemaking process is of, you know, really getting into the details of what treatment is available and what treatment's needed and what analytics are needed in order for produced water to be used for any purposes outside of oil and gas. We're focusing on filling some very important science and technology gaps.
Produced water contains a lot of salt, as well as toxic compounds and heavy metals, including lead and mercury, and in some places, radioactive compounds. Those contaminants can cause cancer and endocrine disruption, among other severe human health problems. Sobel with Wild Earth Guardians says it's what's unknown that's cause for concern.
Less than 1/4 of the nearly 12,000 chemicals that have been identified in produced water can even be detected through standard analytical methods. This is a huge barrier to fully understanding the public health and environmental impacts of oil and gas waste reuse. How can we know what the risks are when we don't know what's in it?
Research from oil fields in Ohio and Louisiana found radioactive residue from produced water on frequently used equipment, including trucks, that could expose workers to harmful carcinogens. Roos says the share of those radioactive compounds in the state's oil wells presents yet another area for study. And while environmentalists like Sobel argue radioactive waste can't be remediated by any method other than diluting it, Ruth says radioactive compounds are not uncommon in New Mexico's groundwater, and there is technology for removing them. Could these measures, as some have said, someday turn the desert green?
We're excited to be moving in this direction in the state of New Mexico, but we're also cautious. So I don't want to get ahead of the science.
Representative Small acknowledges the balance here between enabling new technology to develop through policies that permit its use and not letting that policy get so far ahead of the science that it puts people and drinking water at risk.
And I think as we look across these many different areas, we have seen just the application of innovative approaches guided by strong values and sound science that enable people and environments to coexist and to work with scarce water resources. But again, the terms of the day-to-day research, even the overall arc of that research, I think we have set some very strong standards. We've put additional safeguards. That is one of our biggest jobs. And until that scientific process is undertaken, until some of this information comes back, I think it's inappropriate for us to say one way or the other what will or will not be.
New Mexico's findings could have national or even international implications. The state and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency signed a memorandum in 2018 committing to work together to break ground on the science and the policy guidelines for reusing produced water. Ruse, with the Water Protection Division, says the state is looking to lead.
And the way we're approaching it is setting us apart. And we have federal agencies involved who are viewing the work that we're doing in New Mexico as leading edge and as not just likely to help us set forward good regulations based in sound science in the state of New Mexico, but influence what other states do, influence perhaps what US EPA does down the road for this particular sector. And so a lot of eyes on us.
New Mexico's Energy, Minerals, and Natural Resources Department, which oversees the oil and gas industry, recently approved new guidelines for reusing that wastewater within the industry. But even that prompts some concerns for environmental advocates like Sobol, most of them over spills when this water is handled and trucked to facilities.
An unregulated, toxic, hazardous, and radioactive substance should not be allowed to be regulated as water. And giving the fracking industry this free pass to pollute in New Mexico not only endangers the health of New Mexicans, but endangers everyone and everything downstream.
Produced water spills, which the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has identified as a source of potential contamination to the drinking water supply, are not illegal in New Mexico. Only failing to submit and complete a remediation plan is against the law. The state has recorded more than 7,000 of these spills over the last decade. For Penny O'Coin, the homeowner whose house and yard was sprayed with oil well water, it's a point of great concern.
They're going to continue to have accidents over and over and over again. And then they're going to have people getting sick, dogs dying, livestock dying. And not only that, now they're going to make it sound like, oh, nothing bad ever happens. Because, again, there's nobody being fined. And my daughter is growing up in this.
The meeting to present their first draft of the rules to reuse produced water in the oil field drew comments from Youth United for Climate Crisis Action, or YUCCA.
Hello, my name is Yang Toledo. I come from the Diné Nations in Farmington, New Mexico. I am a first-generation graduate from the New Mexico School for the Arts, and I am currently attending Fort Lewis College. I am a part of the steering committee, Youth United for Climate Crisis Action Steering Committee. I'm a spokesperson for the Diné people.
When Toledo was a high school student driving to and from her hometown and her high school in Santa Fe, She would count the oil wells visible from the highway. Sometimes she saw more than 200. In her comments on these new rules for produced water, Toledo spoke from her heart as a concerned local resident and Indigenous community member.
The Produced Water Act is really threatening our Indigenous people's resources. And so we have to live through these environmental effects that our elected officials decide for us. But they never have stepped foot in our lifestyles of what the struggles we have to go through to access these clean water and to actually have breathable air.
Her conclusion was simple.
If the oil and gas industries don't know where to put the produced water, they should just stop fracking.
New Mexico's legislators have twice seen a bill to put a 4-year moratorium on fracking. But unlike the produced water legislation, which passed both houses with strong support, the fracking ban has yet to make it beyond its first committee hearings. Lawmakers looked at the price tag of an estimated $3.5 billion in revenue from the oil and gas industry in 4 years and said it's not an option the state can afford to consider. For Making Contact, I'm Elizabeth Miller.
You've been listening to Wolves at the Well, the corporate grab of public water on Making Contact. The stories in today's episode were produced by Barbara Bernstein and Elizabeth Miller. This show was produced by Anita Johnson and Monica Lopez. The Making Contact team is Executive Director Sonia Green, Director of Distribution and Production Initiatives Lisa Rudman, show producers Anita Johnson, Salima Hamarani, and Monica Lopez, web updates Sabine Blazin, production assistant Emily Rose Thorne. And I'm your host this week, Monica Lopez. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.